morning. Good morning. So, I'm Babs Rolls Ivy. You didn't hear the normal Babs Rolls Ivy music because we have a new thing that we're doing.
The new thing.
Jeff Grant, who is the executive director of Family Reentry, and I are launching a new thing.
It is a new thing, Babs. And actually, you know, you can read the the opening that I wrote last night if you want, so that everyone knows exactly what we're doing.
Okay.
It's the second one then.
You are listening to Criminal Justice Insider with Babs Rawls Ivy and Jeff Grant on WNHH Community Radio 103.5 New Haven and live streaming at the newhavenindependent.org. Sponsored by Family Reentry, envisioning a first chance society.
You did that beautifully, Babs.
This is what we're doing.
You know, I told our director of reentry this morning, Randy Brown, while I was speaking to him on the phone this morning. He's probably listening in. Hi, Brandy. I told him that you'll be hearing Babs's mellifluous voice and my chicken scratch. So it's perfect.
Jeff has a great voice because he's a musician, and musicians carry their own melody with them anyway. So,
oh yeah, I sound like Miles Davis.
So Jeff and I have been cooking up this idea since we first met, actually. Before I even got to radio, I think we were kind of thinking podcast. We were having this big conversation about doing this. Before you were executive director, before, we were just thinking, how can we raise awareness around criminal justice matters?
Well, at the time, you and I were both on the editorial board of the Justice Imperative. You
yes.
know, the book that got written by the Malta Justice Initiative. And that's when we became friends and started working together on their social media and things like that. And we talked about bringing a criminal justice radio show to Connecticut. As far as I know, there's not one anywhere in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being the voice of criminal justice a little bit and inviting guests on.
Yeah.
Robin Porter, the legislator, has already reached out to us.
And she's my dear friend.
Well, that's probably why she reached out to us.
She is my dear, dear friend.
And she's here in local New Haven.
Yes.
And so I'm going to put a plug in that she be our first guest. And
yes.
So that'll be in.
Yes.
And maybe next month, as we go to our new format, I think on first Fridays of the month.
First Fridays, 10 o'clock, 103.5 WNHH.
But not today. We're not on Friday
not,
today.
We're not on Friday today.
That's
we're
right.
not on Friday this week.
That's right.
So, but we just thought we'd take this opportunity to have a maiden voyage and just sort of talk about these things. Now, we're not always going to be talking about the dreary side of criminal justice, because there's a lot of stories of redemption. There's a lot of hopeful stories. And there are some people around the world that are doing innovative things around criminal justice matters.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you and I both have have had a rocky road. I mean, I don't think it's a surprise to anybody that we've both been
Incarcerated.
There's a good word.
At the federal level, though.
At the federal level.
Let's be criminal justice snobs.
So, you know, there's kind of a rags to riches to redemption story for both of us. And, we're one of the few who are willing to actually talk about it in real time.
Yes.
And and hopefully we're going to give people permission to do that and talk about their frailty and their the difficulties they're going through and the things that they've succeeded on and failed at too. I mean, mm-hmm. It's all part of the journey.
Yes. So, yes. And, you know, Jeff and I are white collar criminals. Oh, no, we're not criminals anymore. We committed white collar crime.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. Yeah. I have to fix that. And so oftentimes white collar folks are hidden. You know, they sort of blend back into some sort of, you hear so much about other types of folks who are incarcerated on reentry and all that, but you never really hear about folks who are what they used to say on the inside, pip crimes.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's really two parts to that, I think. Mm-hmm. And we've discussed this many times, even on the air. I mean, there's the internal battle we go through that I think probably is the largest problem, you know, overcoming shame and guilt and mm-hmm. remorse and inching our way back into being whole people, in both our cases, faithful people. But then there's also the social stigma. There's from the outside, external forces, where not just for white collar criminals, but of course for anybody who's been through the criminal justice system,
yeah.
It's difficult to get a job, housing, substance abuse, treatment, mental health treatment, you know, especially in a moment of Connecticut state history where we were so progressive for such a long time, and our leadership still is progressive, I think, but the money's not there. So a lot of programs have been eliminated, and so a lot of people are out there kind of foraging in the forest for their own nuts. At a time where I think that if we had our choice, we would be providing good wraparound services to help families and communities and reduce recidivism. And the numbers aren't out there yet. Our state has a historic low, at least in the last 30 years, of prison population. But that means there's a lot of people out there on the street who need our help. So hopefully we can give a voice to all that in this radio show over the months and years ahead, and we'll see how it goes.
I hope so, because I do believe that a lot of the awareness raising will have to be around showing people a different side of what people look like when they come out of prison.
Yeah.
I think the Hollywood idea resonates with people's minds oftentimes, that people are hardened and mean and willing to commit crimes to go back. And I think that is not the truth. The folks who are incarcerated across this country are men, women, and children. There are to raise awareness and to put a different spin on the mass media message is a good thing. I think we could be very good at doing that.
Yeah, I think generally that we know the opposite is true. I mean, there's a lot of people who go into prison because they're sick and suffering, or they've come from disadvantaged areas, and everyone's just trying to survive. And in the case of inner city crime, for the most part, there's a lot of pressure to be in gangs. There's a lot of pressure to do things that result in kind of a school to prison pipeline, which most of which is probably not the fault of the people who are suffering from it. And in white collar that we know a lot about, I think at least in my case, there was a defect of character. I put money before everything. I put money before God. Mm-hmm. And ultimately that led to the demise of that life. But when I speak, for example, I give sermons because, I'm a reverend, but also when I speak, people, always ask, like, what's it really like in prison? What's it really like? Because they've seen Oz or Prison Break I can't say that it's not those things, because maybe, but like if you see Orange is the New Black,
yes.
They ask me, is it really like that? And I'll say, well, yeah, but if you take everything that happens in one episode of Orange is the New Black and spread it out over a year,
yeah,
that's pretty much, that might be because as it's just like anything else. I mean, there's a lot of sitting around and reading and being on mm-hmm. your bunk and, mm-hmm. It's pretty boring. I mean, intentionally. I mean, it's not a lot of opportunities for programming in there or for education.
Which is the crazy thing to me, because you've got a committed audience. You're not going anywhere. So why not put services in to sort of benefit and strengthen these, folks, so when they go out, they're much more stronger. But yeah, but Orange is the New Black is based on the Danbury Federal Prison.
It is.
Camp where I was.
Yeah.
And I watched the first season, mm-hmm. and then I was like, "Oh, I don't really need to watch this."
so there's our shout out to Jackie P, our friend Jackie P,
yes,
who was in Danbury, is doing great service to women, all over the area and all over the country. Are coming back, so we're with you. So thank you, Jackie, for that.
And my good friend Beatrice Codiani.
Beatrice, of course.
I met her there, and we are good friends now.
Mm-hmm.
We try to get together and hang out, and she has invited me to stuff and participate in things, mm-hmm. And so she is my good friend, and I talked to her. I haven't talked to her in a minute because she's busy, but
She's the editor of Reentry Central.
Yes.
And she's also in the last year's cohort of Just Leadership USA.
Yes, because I wrote her reference.
I did too.
You did?
I did, yeah.
So she got all the best people writing for her.
Well, she certainly wanted to make sure she got accepted.
So yeah, I just ran her graduation piece. Barbara Fair went, took pictures, and I ran it in the inner city in the last. Because I'm the editor-in-chief of the inner city newspaper here in New Haven. Mm-hmm. And I ran her graduation piece in the paper.
Yeah, well, these are all New Haven advocates who've meant a lot to the you know, to the movement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, just a little pitch for Just Leadership USA, you know, great organization in New York and now around the country, founded by Glenn Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And Glenn and the folks at Catal, Lorenzo Jones and Gabriel Saig, you know, they were successful in getting Mayor de Blasio to commit to closing Rikers, probably not fast enough for what the movement would prefer. But the hashtag Close Rikers has become iconic.
Yes.
Thanks to all these people. And
yes, if you follow them on Twitter, because they have a really great Twitter movement.
Yep, and Beatrice was right in there as a leaders of conviction cohort this year. So definitely a shout out to her.
Mm-hmm. So good morning. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Babs Rawls-Ivey and Jeff Grant. We are launching our new thing, Criminal Justice Insider, on 103.5 New Haven, and live streaming on the New Haven Independent, and it's sponsored by the Family Reentry. So speaking of family reentry, envisioning a first chance society, it's your anniversary.
And it is my anniversary. Actually, October 1st of last year, I became the executive director of Family Reentry. So, I can't believe that it's been a year already.
Oh my God, it just flew by.
It did fly by. And as you know, I'm the first person in the country incarcerated for a white collar crime to be appointed as the executive director of a major nonprofit organization in the country.
Isn't that odd? Do you find that odd? Like, don't you think more people would be doing that? No, maybe.
There's a lot of people who've been to prison who are heads of criminal justice organizations in the country, but none for white collar crimes.
Okay.
And I get that. I mean, it's a big, bold step that our board of directors made. And you know, people who've gone to prison for white collar crimes, are most of us have committed crimes of trust.
Yes.
And it takes a lot to restore that. I mean, for me, it took 10 years to get appointed. And through that, I had to do a lot of volunteer work. And, you know, I went to seminary. I went to Union Theological Seminary and got a Master's of Divinity and spent 2 years preaching as associate pastor and director of prison ministries at the First Baptist Church in Bridgeport.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a shout out to Hopeton Scott. We're giving a lot of shout outs because we're figuring, I figure the more people we engage, the more they'll listen in the next month. But, you know, it gave me my first job. And then, you know, my wife, Lynn Springer, and I founded a...
Who is quite beautiful, I must say.
And talented and smart and committed and a beautiful woman of faith and who I'm in love with.
I'm in love with her, too, honestly.
Well, everyone who meets her is in love with her, but just hands off, Babs. And so we started a ministry in Greenwich for white-collar criminals and their families. That was the first of its kind in the country. And so we got a lot of media, we got a lot of press because, you know, people are kind of drawn to the sensationalism of the white collar story, but that's not really what the story is. I mean, the story is reaching out to people who are pressed and suffering in all kinds of different ways, and not just the people who've committed the crimes, but certainly their families, their children who are stigmatized. And, you know, we know so many people in these affluent communities where the women and the children are left behind, and other parents won't let their kids play with the children of these families of incarceration, and they're kicked out of their churches and synagogues, and they're you know, there's a lot of Schadenfreude, you know, people waiting for the rich and famous to fail, and although most of these people are not rich and famous, they're kind of ordinary, you know, you know, accountants, lawyers, whatever. But we went through that whole journey together, Lynn and I, and then now on to Family Reentry, where I was on the board of directors for almost 8 years, and tried to contribute there. And they appointed me last year, so it's a year.
Oh my gosh!
And
we should. Well, you don't drink, but I'll drink some champagne for you.
I do not drink. I've had enough for a lifetime, Babs.
I'll pop some champagne for you. Yeah. And so we're going to shout out our friend Andrew Kaplan.
Oh yeah, this is one of our trademarks. We got Andrew's our dear friend, and I know you're listening out there, Andrew. So
Andrew's going to keep us in content.
Oh yeah, that's one of the promises Babs and I made each other, that we would mention Andrew every show.
Every show, Andrew.
until he objects.
I love Andrew Kaplan. He's my good friend. We hang out.
I know you do.
We hang out, and he will keep us in content.
Listen, when he's not mountain climbing or traveling
the world, or learning, going to France, going to Canada to learn French, to go to France,
or going to South America to learn Spanish. I mean, who does that?
He's on a new terror now.
He is.
He's a Coco Chanel, reading about Coco Chanel, so now he's smelling all these scents.
Oh, you know, my stepdaughter did the whole Coco Chanel thing too. So, we'll all get together.
So this is a thing. Yeah. So you're in good company, Andrew. So
yeah, for sure.
So what do you think we want to do with this show?
Well, to me, the most important thing is to have kind of a broad conversation that keeps going on about what it really is to be involved in the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. from different aspects. I mean, it's so easy to just to say, you know, I'm someone who made a mistake and I went to prison and then I have my story. And of course, our personal stories are probably always the most powerful. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to invite a conversation amongst people who don't usually get a voice and who don't even know that they can share their voice. You know, at Family Reentry, when I started a year ago, I mean, we certainly had the best reputation for programs, criminal justice programs, yes. in the state, I would
yes.
say.
Yes.
But what happened was that like most nonprofits, and certainly criminal justice nonprofits, we kind of weren't showing up in Albany. We weren't making our voice heard. And that's a particular form of advocacy where we really care about the impact. We care about moving the needle and really making a difference. But tucked away here in kind of Fairfield County, whether it's from Bridgeport all the way to Greenwich, you know, it takes some effort to go to Hartford.
Yeah.
And so the first thing we decided was that we were going to stand up and make a difference and take positions. And maybe those positions weren't going to necessarily make people in power there, whether in the executive branch or in the judicial or in the legislature. It might not make them happy. But at least we're not being cowards. I mean, you know, it takes some courage to actually try to make a difference. So we did that, and we started showing up at the Appropriations Committee, and we're showing up at the Nonprofit Alliance meetings, and we're in there in the rallies, mm-hmm. and we show up for as many things as we can. And so that's what the kind of behavior and the kind of opportunity that we're looking to encourage on this show, and whatever the progeny of the show is, whatever it turns out to be, mm-hmm. that, you know, people let's really hear from you and discuss what's really going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, and no platitudes. I mean, this is not, you know, I'm not saying that we can avoid, you know, commentary or, I mean, the kind of commentary where people are advocating for a specific position. And that's okay. But like, what does it really mean to people? What does it mean to you? How does it affect me on the ground? And what am I doing about it? Or how do I discover what opportunities are out there to actually do something that's going to improve the lives of our families, our community, and the state, and then and the country?
Yes, I like that. I think what happens is you're so busy doing the work that you forget that you have to make these connections and you have to sort of reach to Hartford because they have to see you. You know, they can't just, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, we know Reentry does good work. Boom. They have to see you and they have to see the people who you represent. That goes the long way. Having been a legislator on the local level, seeing people makes a difference than just reading about people. So.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to our dear producer.
Brian Slatery.
Hey, Brian. we were talking just before the show. And we were talking about how easy it is to become complacent. And even when you're kind of doing the good work, you know, if what we're doing is we have state contracts, for example, I mean, it's easy to kind of fall into complacency of just performing those contracts or making nice and not doing the hard work it takes to really focus on vision, or when money gets tight as it is now in the state, mm-hmm. to do the cost cutting and really drill down into, you know, what the kerygma is, what the kernel, the nut is of what mm-hmm. we're trying to do, mm-hmm. and then grow from there something that's new and different and exciting, and bring that and be unafraid to kind of bring that to the people who are the decision makers. And my experience has been that they want to hear from us. I mean, that's what's happened.
I agree. Talk a little bit about, because Connecticut is the only state right now that doesn't have a budget.
We don't have a budget.
What does that do for your organization? Like, what does that stall you? Does it? Can you not make moves? Like, what is happening? And you still have to carry out, because you have people who come to you for support.
Well, I think that in a lot of ways that's true. I mean, it limits our decision making for sure, and we've had to do some forms of cutback, you know, staff furloughs, and in many cases, I mean, last year we lost a lot of behavioral programs. In July of 2016, the Department of Corrections, through budget cutting, was forced to cut back all non-residential behavioral health programming in the state, or at least mandated behavioral health program. So that means family reentry lost a lot of that budget. But this year we did okay. I mean, the Department of Corrections enforced a 4.5% decrease in everyone's budget. Mm-hmm. And that was livable. You know, we're grateful for the other 95.5% for sure. I mean, I'll take 95.5% any day in this kind of climate. We're growing in other parts, in the judicial department, community support services division, CSSD. We're growing, actually. We've actually grown by about 50% in the last year, even through this budget crisis. But, you know, it's made us kind of go deeper into who we are, and doing private fundraising and foundations mm-hmm. and major gifts. And we've reassessed all of that, and we've decided that it's not good enough just to fulfill government contracts. Our job is to be creative and inventive and encourage. I mean, my personal commitment is to kind of bridge the affluent neighborhood areas and the inner city community. So, you know, I've lived in and around Greenwich for 30 years, I've worked in Bridgeport for almost the last 10. And it's amazing that these two communities are the most economically disparate two communities of any county in the country. Mm-hmm. And there they are, 20 miles from each other, and they haven't been brought together in a significant way. And that's my personal mission, is to bring them together and recognize this is a problem that affects everybody. And if you're just going to point, if sitting in Greenwich and you're going to point to Bridgeport and say, you know, the problem's over there, it's just not true. but you can live in denial all you want, but just read the papers, open up the front yes. page, and there's crime is everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And
as is criminal justice. So, I mean, that's certainly something I hope to bring to this show over the next time periods.
And, you know, what strikes me too is that there are people out and around this country that are doing some amazing things around criminal justice. You know, and I really got a flavor for it when we were hosting when we were co-editing the Justice Imperative blog, how people around this country are doing some amazing things, working with reentry folks and just doing their part. It's been phenomenal, and you don't get to hear it because it doesn't make the news. You know, the good news doesn't make the news.
Well, I think here's a problem embedded in this, because there's a lot of people doing good work, but I hope what we're not doing is preaching to the choir.
Right.
You know, I mean, you could go to a criminal justice conference three times a day, every day of the year now. And what I hope
is that true.
Yeah, it's true, right?
Because I get invited.
Yeah.
Like, no, I'm not
but,
coming to
but
that.
I hope what's not happening is that we're just talking to the same people over and mm-hmm. over again, because it's just ego if we're not getting anything done.
Right.
You know, so I mean, I think none of us have any interest in seeing our name in print or, you know, being the host of a radio show, for example, if we're not actually reaching out to new people and people who can make a difference in this fight.
Yes. I see your point. I really do see your point. I think for me, just to dispel myths about reentry and criminal justice and what that looks like and what a person who has gone to prison looks like, I'm very much interested in allaying, you know, stopping those myths and raising awareness around, you know, what happens to families, what happens to communities. You know, it's not just, you know, when somebody goes to prison, everybody connected to that person goes to prison.
Exactly.
Everybody goes to prison with you, you know. And I want to talk about how expensive it is to be in prison, to make the phone calls, you know. Some prisons you can't even get to. You know, your family members can't even get you, can't even get to see you. And I just saw this thing and I sent it to you where there's a prison somewhere that's doing away with visits. You have to have a video. You're going to get a video.
And a lot of them.
And you have to pay for the video of your loved one. I was like, who thinks this is? And these things happen because the spotlight is not on them. You know, they can do these things without anybody sort of saying, hey, that's not a good idea. We're not going to let you do that. You know?
You know, without getting too deep into the ethics of video visits, because obviously if... The human contact is critical, you know, to the children of incarceration,
yes,
who don't get to see their mother or their father who's incarcerated, and couples are disenfranchised, and there's a whole reordering of the family unit during and even after incarceration. But Family Reentry is sponsoring with Shared Studios a prison portal project, which, mm-hmm. you know, we presented at the governor's conference,
yes.
In June. And again, this is not like a commentary on the ethics of video visits, but what we did was we reached out to them because they have this immersive technology where they put a portal, what they call a portal, which is really a shipping container that's tricked out with all kinds of high tech. And so if you enter one of these portals, you can, in real time, be face to face with someone in a portal in another part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, so for example, for those who can see us on Facebook Live, it's as if Babs and I were in the same room, but we could actually be thousands of miles apart. So mm-hmm. they have portals in Iraq and Afghanistan and China and inner cities and everywhere. But we're proud that we've partnered with them for criminal justice, and we're going to be putting the first portal in a U.S. prison system. We're going to be putting it in the spring now in York Correctional, in the women's prison there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and another portal in downtown, the city of Bridgeport. Bridgeport City Council has already passed it, so thank you, Mayor Ganim, for that. Another one of our compatriots. And So families that can't afford to go to prison, can't miss a day of work, can't pull their kids out of school, can't travel the 2 hours to get to an institution or 3 hours to get to an institution where their loved one is serving time, we can actually put the family and that person together in mm-hmm. real time in this kind of immersive experience. And it works. We just haven't tested it in a prison yet. But we're very grateful that Shared Studios is actually going to have a portal in Times Square for 6 weeks, or maybe it's 8 weeks, I can't remember. But starting next week, the portal will be right in the middle of Times Square, and it's going to be curated and programmed. And in November, that week, for one of those weeks, it's going to be called Change Week. And it's going to be curated by one of their paid curators who's from the inner city in Milwaukee, because they have a portal there. Wonderful guy named Lewis. And we three members of Family Reentry will be on November 15th. We will be in a portal in downtown Brooklyn, because we have to travel to where they have a portal and they have a headquarters down there. And so Fred Hodges, Dyee, McKnight, and I will be in that portal, and we will be communicating in this immersive experience. And I'll be facilitating a conversation about criminal justice with people who are in inner cities all over the country, or maybe the world. That's Share Studios will figure that one out. And but people in Times Square can come in and have this conversation with us and learn not just about what it is to be involved in criminal justice in this country, but also about the technology and what we can do to bring more humanity and more and more and more love to a situation where, you know, it can be pretty cruel and pretty heartless.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna look forward to hearing more about this. Because in my mind, I love the technology. I'm a tech person. I love the technology of things. I don't ever want us to lose sight of the human connection over technological gains. That's my concern.
Oh, it's a big one. Yeah, you're right.
You know, I mean, we do this. We use that technology all the time. Anyway, mm-hmm. We Skype. We have virtual meetings. We text, we are already doing it, but I just, you know, for people in prison, I don't want it to be an additional sentence.
Oh yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
So I'm thoughtful about that, and I have to see it.
Well, I mean, like anything else, you know, you try a little bit and you see how it's working.
Yeah.
I mean, we've gotten reach outs from some big media outlets to cover it. Vice Media has reached out, for example. And we would love to do that with them. You know, I'm not sure how much we have to test it and we have to kind of work it out before we really invite that kind of scrutiny into it. Because, you know, it can kind of take on a life of its own. And we're trying to do something meaningful, but I don't think anybody's under the illusion that there's going to be that there's going to be hits and misses. There's going to be some mistakes made along the way. And
but to your point, you know, people can't go see loved ones far away, particularly in the federal system, because people can be moved. You know, you don't necessarily get to be someplace in your state. You can be moved far away.
Diesel therapy.
You know, and yeah. And, you know, you can't just pick up and, you know, go to Alabama or whatever, or wherever your people are, you know, serving their time.
Yeah. I mean, there's supposed to be rules, like in the federal system, there are supposed to be rules that you're supposed to be within, designated within 500 miles of your, of where you live, mostly to facilitate, you know, your community being in contact with you. But that doesn't always happen. And 500 miles is pretty far, too.
It is far.
Yeah.
I mean, So, I mean, you know, those are the kinds of things that we'll talk about.
We're talking about it now.
We can get more, you know, maybe we'll have somebody to come on and talk about this. And we plan on having guests, right? Call-ins.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know.
Although I'm not a fan of call-ins, but.
Listen, you know,
I could entertain it.
WNHH has its own technology here.
We do.
Yeah, I know. You know, the carrier pigeon, whatever you've got going.
So we could stack this room with guests and people who are interested in what we're interested in, or who may have an opposing opinion about things.
Where are they going to sit, Babs?
Listen, when we do pundits in here on Friday, it's what Brian? Six people in here. There's a lot of people in here because you look, three, somebody could sit here. Look, there's a mic there. Do you see that mic?
Yeah.
Three. There's a lot of people. We could fit a lot of people in here.
Yeah, six small people.
So you have to see it. It really does work. You slide over a little bit. There's a chair there. I'm here. Somebody sits here. Somebody sits over there. Right? So
Babs, I've been to prison. You don't have to convince me that six people can fit in a small space.
I know, right? Why am I doing that? I'm like, I know. That's why, you know what? Well, when people talk about these little tiny houses, I was like, ooh, you like those because you've never been to prison. If you've been to prison, you don't want a tiny house.
Yeah, or you're used to it.
I'm not used to
it. No.
I was like, ooh, I need at least 3,000 square feet.
No. So what else is on our cheat sheet here?
Oh, Lord. So, you know, Jeff being the stand-up guy that he is, he created a whole list of 12 things that we should be doing and talking about. I was like, oh, this is so good. This is so good. So we talked about you celebrating 1-year anniversary. Yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about the state budget crisis.
And that'll be an ongoing conversation.
It'll be an ongoing conversation. The recent webinar with Scott Simple and Vera Institute of Justice, the true unit at Cheshire Correctional for 18 to 24-year-olds. What is that about?
There was a webinar, I think it was yesterday, it may have been the day before, but I think it was yesterday. And Scott Semple, our very progressive commissioner of corrections, who we adore and who we acknowledge is probably feeling the pinch of the budget cut to criminal justice sector, probably more than anybody, because I know he would love to deliver progressive programming and a whole new way of doing things. And I'm sure it's difficult to do under these circumstances. But they do have this initiative. And what happened was a few years ago, a bunch of people from around the country, sponsored by Vera Institute of Justice, they went over to Germany and they took a look at the German model.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I remember this.
And it's a completely different form of justice. It's much more rehabilitative and not punishing as our system here in the United States. And they kind of got enlightened as to the way people do things around the world. I mean, certainly in Scandinavia, they do things differently. We know in Canada, they do things differently. And in some areas of the world, it's a lot more oppressive. We know people who've been in third world kind of prison situations where it's harsh.
Yeah.
But they got enlightened. And so they're partnering with Vera to bring this into Connecticut. And they started this this unit in Cheshire Correctional called the True Unit, in which 18 to 24 year olds are who now have a different kind of sentencing in the state due to a lot of progressive thinking and legislation passing, and they have this unit where they kind of grow and learn together, and they're in this this kind of therapeutic community, and what they have is mentors who are. I think they're primarily lifers, I think, but they're people who are embedded in the system who've learned how to cope and bring character development and things to young men who probably were deprived of those type of life lessons when they were young. And I don't know that there's a lot of statistics yet about the success, but I think anecdotally they can see that things are changing for the better. And of course, we know that 95% of the people who go to prison come out of prison and become our neighbors. So we get to choose as a society and as electorate, we get to choose how we want to treat them in prison. And for the last 30 years, we've probably chosen pretty badly. But the new enlightenment is let's make better citizens of people while they're in prison, while they're available, and they're more open to third-party suggestions, and they have this excess capacity of time and things like that. And here, in particular, there's a model being that was in the webinar. There's a model that we can see where it's starting with youth, but it's really going to spread out to whole new forms of corrections and community corrections, where it's not going to be based upon the same kind of captivity, the same kinds of incarcerating mass amounts of people in these huge prisons, and how we get there and who's going to pay for it and what the testing going to be and the pilots. I mean, to be determined, but, at Family Reentry, we've been in contact and, we're certainly open to piloting some, residential programs and things like that. So, exciting. And, it was great to be part of that webinar yesterday. We had a bunch of people from Family Reentry, Fred Hodges, our director of community affairs, and Randy Brarin and John Mealy were all sitting in. And I think that we're prepared to co-partner with the Department of Corrections and Vera and anyone else who wants to get involved. And certainly the wonderful nonprofit community here in Connecticut that just gives of itself so thanklessly for so little remuneration, people.
Work. I like this idea of this innovative thought because I think we're going to have to, as a country, decide to move away from mass incarceration. It's costly, it's expensive, and I don't, unless you make the correlation between for-profit prisons and the need for hyper mass incarceration to keep that for-profit prison lucrative, then you can make those leaps.
Well, I mean, as you and I both know, you know, every prison is a for-profit prison. I mean, you can't really look at a public prison and not consider it a for-profit prison. It's a lot of people making a profit on it.
And it's true, Jeff.
But bringing them to the table, you know, in a constructive way. I mean, I don't see why, for example, every single person who provides something to a prison, like every candy bar in the commissary, every mattress, I can't see why they shouldn't be asked to contribute to justice reinvestment, to contribute to the communities.
Wow.
You know, and
wow. You know, can you imagine?
Well, if prison is an $80 billion industry, and that's just directly, I mean, in this country, I mean, wouldn't it be nice if they could contribute 1%
of what
back to the communities?
Wow. Can you imagine that?
I mean, that would be $800 million.
Oh my God.
Back into investing in communities. So if I'm calling for our criminal justice system and our prison system to put a surcharge on these private companies in order to do business with them so the money can go back into the communities, that's what I'm asking. I guess that's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm asking.
That's powerful.
Why not?
That's some good thinking. I like that thinking a lot.
Well, I mean, there's one of many, you know. Yeah, I mean, that's it. There's a lot of good ideas out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of good ideas. And what we're going to do on Criminal Justice Insider with me and Jeff Grant, we're going to bring these things to the forefront.
We're trying. Boy, we've used up a lot of time already.
I know. How about that? What, 5 minutes? We got like 5 minutes.
Is it only 5 minutes?
Yeah.
What time do we run to?
Well, we try to run to like 10 of, because the next show... Because there's some technological things that needs to happen to set up for the next.
Yeah, sure, to fit 18 people in here.
Listen, we've had concerts in here.
Oh, yeah, that's what it is. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, like on the HG network, they're always dropping walls.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's
like
it.
Overnight.
That's it. That's what we do it all here.
Yeah.
And Brian is sitting in for Harry Droz. Harry Droz is the station manager.
Oh, yeah.
And the producer. And so so Brian Slatery has so graciously sitting in the big chair.
Yeah, we like Brian.
Yes, we like Brian. And he's, you know, we work well together. So, and he's a musician in his own right.
Oh, good.
Well, yes.
Maybe we'll jam. Maybe I'll bring a guitar in.
You should. So I want to get to this. I want to have some conversation around. You sent me a piece on addiction and entrepreneurial stuff. The Inc.com article that came out yesterday. Entrepreneurship as a precursor to addiction in the state. And how that looks at the Connecticut's opioid crises, you know, and your own addiction. We don't have to get to your addiction yet because we got 5 minutes. But I didn't make that leap with that until you sent me that piece. I did not make the correlation between that. I just didn't. So if I didn't, imagine how many other people didn't either.
Well, you know, I don't have to be the one to tell you that we have an opioid crisis in this country, but of course, you know, this, the opioid crisis is now coming to the forefront and being regarded, in my opinion, mostly because it affects, a lot of white people, you know,
mm-hmm.
The crisis has been in the inner city forever, for a long time,
mm-hmm.
you know, but, you know, they don't call it, there hasn't been this much attention. And I mean, what's that say about our society that, and again, I mean, there's a lot of kids dying out there and of course it's important, but, there've been a lot of kids dying for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So, in my personal case, you know, I was addicted to opioids for 10 years, and the writer from this from Inc.com, who writes the entrepreneur column, I was having breakfast with him about a week ago, And he said, you know, how did that affect, you know, you were an entrepreneur and I was a lawyer and I was a businessman. And how did my opioid, my prescription narcotic addiction affect my life? And how did it affect? I said, well, it affected everything. I mean, I told him, I said, you know, I was getting prescription narcotics from a doctor or doctors for 10 years. And it brought down my my business, brought down my law firm, it brought down my life, my family, everything got affected. And, you know, it started me on a new life, but and hopefully 15 years later, a productive one, because I'm 15 years clean and sober now.
Yay.
Yeah, that's a good shout out.
That's a good shout out.
But not everybody has that opportunity and certainly to drill down into it and to present stories of how it affects individuals and what my story is as it relates to that addiction and how it destroyed my life. Mm-hmm. And to open up the show, for example, to, because it led me into the criminal justice system, obviously. So he wrote this article that's on Inc.com, and it's called Entrepreneurship as a Precursor to Addiction. And I mean, I think part of the reason he wrote it is because not that many people necessarily are gonna find it if it's kind of about white collar crime, but which is true. But about the opioid crisis, certainly it's something that people can relate to in a much broader way, and it's true. So he wrote this article, and you know, I sent it around to some friends last night, and in fact, I sent it to Lynn. And she was reading it. She was next to me, you know, lying in bed, and she was reading the article. And then, like 3/4 of the way or 2/3 of the way down the article, my story's in the middle of the article. And she said, "Yeah, like, why did you tell me about this?" And I said, "Well, you know, honestly, I just found it online myself." So there it is.
It really was. It makes a compelling story, a compelling case for the intersection of drug abuse and crime. In a way that I don't think we've paid attention. I mean, I think when we think about drug abuse and crime, we think somebody's going to break into your house and steal your little microwave and
exactly.
Your CD players and all that kind of stuff. We're not thinking about what it takes, what happens to people when they are functioning at these high-level kind of entrepreneurial things. I found that wholly fascinating. It's like, whoa.
Well, at least in my case, it was a complete disintegration of judgment, of you know, wild risk taking, because I wasn't focused on the outcomes of anything. I wasn't focused on the consequences. I mean, I did things that I would never have let a client do. Mm-hmm. Never. But I was in the thralls of my addiction, and it was greater than my love for my family, my love of my business, my love for myself. Mm-hmm. You know, it was bigger than anything. My love of God, you know, it came before anything, and ultimately the price got paid. And I'm very, very grateful and fortunate to, you know, to have come back to the point where at least I have a ability to share that, and hopefully and encourage and give people a voice to talk about their stories. And maybe what we can do collectively is fight this all together through authenticity, through truth. And, you know, the preaching, you know, I mean, so everything's got its important part, but people come forward with their stories. I think that's going to be what's most powerful.
Well, if you tuned in today expecting to hear Love Baths, Love Talk, you didn't get that. What you got was Criminal Justice Insider with Babs Rawls-Ivey and Jeff Grant. Jeff Grant is the Executive Director of Family Reentry. We will be back November 3rd at 10 a.m.
At 10 a.m., first Friday.
Friday.
It's alliterative, first Friday.
First Friday of every month.
It is.
We will be here, 10 o'clock. So we'll see you then. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Babs. Love you.
Thank you, Jeff. Love you.
All right.
Bye, Andrew.